Thanks, Richard. Okay, so Richard tells me you've already heard a bit about quantum mechanics, and you're going to be hearing a lot more today. And there's two things I want to try to tell you about. One is some of the interesting things you can do with quantum mechanics. So often quantum mechanics is thought of as sort of restrictive, restricts what you can do. But recently we found that actually it expands on what you can do for certain kinds of information processing tasks. So I'm going to tell you a bit about that, how you can do some interesting things with it. But I think even more interesting than that is what it all means. And there's a lot of controversy over what quantum mechanics means. So I'm going to delve into that. I'm going to tell you a bit about hidden variable theories, and I'm going to end with Bell's theorem. So it's going to be very conceptual, a very little mathematics. I think it'll still be enough to get all the ideas across. And do interrupt me at any time if there's a question or if there's something that's unclear. So I like to start talks on quantum theory with this Far Side cartoon. I'll give you a minute to read it. I hear an but for international students who might not be familiar with the term jerks, I don't know if you can read that. That's very annoying people. And so the reason this is relevant is that quantum theory to physicists is a bit like jerks. It's very annoying and it makes life difficult. But on the other hand, it also makes life interesting. So I'm personally in foundations of quantum mechanics, and originally I was really attracted to it because it's so mysterious. And really, I think it's fair to say that of the interpretational problems of physics, how to interpret quantum mechanics is one of the most vexing problems. So just a bit of history, you've probably already heard this. Quantum mechanics in its present form was essentially developed in the 20s by people like Schrodinger and Heisenberg, de Broglie, Einstein, here, four. And I'm not going to tell you, as I said, about the formalism. I'm just going to leap straight into some of the predictions of quantum theory at a macroscopic level. So what do you see in the lab? What does quantum theory predict? So just some simple quantum phenomena. Now, you may have, you will be familiar with some of this. All I'm going to really tell you about is the Stern-Gerlach apparatus. So the idea is that you have here an oven that spits out atoms, say silver atoms, and you feed them into the gap between a couple of magnets that are shaped in such a way that you have a non-uniform magnetic field here. And because of the magnetic dipole of the atoms, they get deflected by that magnetic field. And as Richard already told you, what you find, surprisingly, is that they only get ever deflected upwards or downwards, and there's not a spectrum of deflections. There's just up or down. So that's what we see. And if we look for the atom and ask, well, how frequently does it go up and how frequently does it go down, we find that if we slow down, if we make it sure that we only have one atom passing through the apparatus at a given time, and we look for that atom, we find half the time the atom goes up and half the time it goes down. And you know, no matter how we refine things, you know, if we make our experiments better, we just seem to get closer and closer to 50-50. So that's interesting. Now, I don't want to always be drawing this, so I'm actually going to summarize this whole situation where the magnets are aligned up along the z-axis by a box that looks like this one. It has a little input port and an output port, and it says z on it. And whether you got up or down is just going to be indicated by a little light that turns on. Okay, so if you get the up outcome, then a green light turns on. And if this is the oven of the silver atoms and I press the button to spit one atom out, then half the time the green light comes on and half the time the red light comes on. Okay, so that's the first sort of device we need. The second device is very similar, except that the magnet is now rotated to be such that the south pole is up along the x direction. And when you do this, and you feed in the atoms from the oven, you find exactly the same sort of thing. You get half the time the atoms being detected up along the x-axis, and half the time they're detected down. So I'm going to indicate that experiment by a box with just an x on it and these two possible outcomes. Okay, Those are the basic ingredients. Now, suppose I turn on the oven, pass it through one of these Z-boxes, and then I pass it through another Z-box. Well, I get 50-50 up or down on the first one. Okay, so let's say I got the green outcome. Now, what happens on the second one? 100% of the time, you get the green outcome, exactly. And it doesn't matter how many times you repeat this measurement of Z, you always get the green outcome. And if you get the red outcome, then the red outcome repeats indefinitely as you repeat that experiment. And the same thing is true for X measurements. If I get the green outcome on the first, then I get the green outcome on the second, red, and then red. Okay, so consecutive identical measurements always yield the same outcome. That's the first thing we observe and that we should keep in mind. Okay, now something a bit more interesting. Suppose I do a Z measurement and I get the green outcome, and then I do an X measurement. What do I get? What's that? You get red 50% of the time, and 50% of the time you get green. So somebody said 50-50. That's right. So half the time you get green, half the time you get red. Similarly, if I get the red outcome for Z, I get 50-50 statistics. It's what we observe. And no matter how you refine, if you try to make these experiments better and better, you always just get closer to 50-50 as you refine the quality of your experiments. So the moral here is that the outcome of an X measurement is uncorrelated with the outcome of an immediately preceding Z measurement. This is what we find. And the same thing holds true if we do X and then Z. The outcome of the Z measurement is found to be completely uncorrelated with the outcome of the X measurement. So that's the second fact you have to bear in mind. Okay, so now we get to something more interesting, maybe truly interesting. You shouldn't be able to call the answer to this one. Suppose we do a Z measurement, we happen to get the green outcome. Now, what's going to happen with the X measurement? 50-50 statistics, exactly. So say I get the red outcome. Now, the question is, what if I do a Z measurement after that? So there's two possibilities. Suppose there's two intuitions as to what might happen. Suppose I got rid of the Z measurement, the first one. Suppose it wasn't there. Then that's a situation we've seen already. What would you expect? 50-50, right, because you've got X red, and then you know that the outcome of the Z is uncorrelated with the outcome of the X. But suppose I got rid of the X measurement, what would you expect? I didn't quite catch that. 100% green, exactly, because subsequent Z measurements, you always get the same outcome repeating. So you have these two competing intuitions as to what's going to happen. So how many people think it's going to be 100% green? And okay, how many people think it's going to be 50-50? Okay, well, you go, you do the experiment, and you find it's 50-50. So you really have no way of calling that ahead of time. So you know, if you guessed 100% green, that's not a problem. You have to do the experiment. And the moral of the story is that if you have an X measurement intervening between two Z measurements, then it randomizes the outcome. So I don't get the same outcome for the Z measurement here as I got the first time, by virtue of having this intervening X measurement. And the same thing holds true if I did X, Z, X. The intervening Z measurement would randomize the X outcome. Okay, so that's the third fact you have to keep in mind. And with these basic facts about the phenomenology of Stern-Gerlach, we can go a long way towards understanding interesting quantum phenomena. So let's jump into it. Imagine that you have a wall here. Okay, and behind the wall, there's an apparatus which is preparing these systems. And there's somebody outside, say, in the world, who doesn't see behind this wall, doesn't know precisely what's going on here. And in the first case, I want to imagine that this person's told that the system has been prepared with a Z measurement, a Z box, but doesn't know whether the outcome was green or red. And the system is passed out to that person, and the person's asked to figure out whether it was prepared according to green or red, whether the outcome behind the wall was green or red. So how can they do it? Sorry, did you say it again?
Another Z experiment.
Right. Exactly. So put another Z box, feed the system through another Z box, and whatever outcome you get here, because the Z outcomes always repeat, consecutive identical measurements always have the same outcome, you can retrodict what happened. So if you get the green outcome, then you know back here it must have been green, and if you get the red outcome, then you know it must have been red. So this is a problem we can solve. This guy can figure out what happened behind the wall. So it's possible to distinguish Z green from Z red just by doing this sort of measurement. And the same is true for if he was told that it was an X box and wasn't told whether it was green or red, he could figure it out by doing an X measurement. Okay, now here's a different problem. Suppose that the guy outside the wall isn't told both whether it was Z or X, so he doesn't know whether it was Z or X, and he doesn't know whether it was green or red. Now what can he do? Yes? Tilt. So between Z and X, I think. He could do that. So I think Richard told you a bit about the fact that, you know, you could have string galaxies at any angle. I haven't mentioned that here. What happens is, you know, if I start with something that's prepared Z green, and then I put it through a box that's tilted, say, a little bit from Z, then you get, you know, 90% green and 10% red. And as I tilt it away, I get a cosine squared dependence of, you know, the probability of getting the green outcome. The problem is that even if I do tilt it at this angle, I still can't estimate with certainty whether it was Z green or Z red, X green or X red. So turns out that that extra trick doesn't help resolve this issue of which of the four it was. Yeah?
Let's say you put a Z, right?
Yeah.
Then if it's like green, you know it. Well, if it's just green, you know that it's a Z green. If it's red, Z red. But if it turns out 50-50, you know there was an X. And then you can get an X one and do the same experiment.
Okay, so that will work if the problem were slightly different. So let me thank you for the point, because I can refine the problem now. I'm going to imagine that this has to be done. Let me just finish this first. There's just the one system that comes out. So had there been, say, 1,000 systems, and you're told, look, these were all prepared using the exact same box, right? So maybe they're all prepared Z, and I only sent you the ones that had the red outcome. So you've got 1,000 samples of this thing. And you're trying to figure out whether those 1,000 are Z red, Z green, X red, or X green, and they're all the same. Then you can do Z measurements on some of them and X measurements on others, and figure out whether you get half-half for X and green. You know, say you got always green for the Z and half-half for the X's. Then you say, aha, they were all prepared X green. But this problem is slightly different, because I'm saying you only have one sample. So you know, when you do if you did an X measurement, you don't know if you're getting, you know, green half the time or green 100% of the time, because you're only doing it once. Does that make sense?
Oh, so what you're saying, you can't do it two times. You can't do the experiment two times.
Yeah, you have only the one system. Let's consider what would happen if you did consecutive measurements. So if you did X and then X, well, you're not learning anything new, because you know that the outcome will always repeat, right? So if you got green the first time, you'll always get green. So it's not as if you're going to get, you know, random outcomes. Whatever you got the first time, that's what's going to repeat. Now, you were suggesting that you could do X and then Z. So that doesn't really help you, though, because remember from a couple of slides ago, let's go back, the second Z measurement, so let's say that the thing behind the wall was Z green. The second Z measurement isn't going to tell you that was green. It's going to give you a random outcome. So if you do an X measurement first, and then a Z measurement, that doesn't help you tell what was done here.
But if it was Z red, the X would be green. So you can see if the X is red, then the third is random. So the Z is green. you can see that if we one color, the other color can run. So you have a relationship that you can see there.
But with a single run, you can never see that something's random. You just get one outcome. And so you could never, when you just do it once, there's no indication that you know, you've got green 50% of the time, because you've only done it once. So you don't know whether this is 100% green or 50% green. So let me go back to where we were. Okay, so let me take us through this. Suppose you chose to do the Z measurement, okay, and you got the green outcome. What does that allow you to infer about what was behind the wall? What are the possibilities for what was here? So, right, I think I've heard them all. There are three possibilities. One is that it was Z and green, because that can just repeat. Another was that it's X and green, because if it was X and green, then you know that with a Z measurement here, half the time you get green and half the time you get red. So this green outcome is consistent with this preparation. Okay, and similarly, if you get X red, that's also consistent with getting Z green afterwards. Okay, so you have these three possibilities that are all consistent with that outcome. So you haven't figured out which of the four it was. All you've done is rule out one of them. You've ruled out Z red, but you still have this ambiguity as to which of the other three it was. You know that it's slightly more likely to have been Z green than either of these two, but you still don't know with certainty which it was. And that's true for any measurement you do here, any single measurement. And if you follow it up by another measurement, it doesn't help because the outcome of that measurement is found to be totally random. It doesn't have anything to do with what was here, as we said earlier. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so the moral of the story here is that it's impossible to distinguish between these four different kinds of preparation, Z green, Z red, X green, and X red. And I haven't told you about the full set of quantum measurements. We had a question about that. You know, what if it was at a slightly different angle, Stringer-like? But if you do the mathematics, you find that that doesn't help you, because those sorts of measurements don't even have deterministic outcomes. So you never get probability one of some outcome, probability zero of the other, which is the sort of thing you need to be able to predict what this was with probability one. Okay, so this is a key phenomenon. I'm going to use this in telling you about the power of quantum theory for doing interesting things. But I need to do one calculation, which is to figure out what the probability of correctly estimating which of those four preparations it was. So it's very simple. You just have to take the probability of getting Z versus X right times the probability of getting red versus green right, given that you got Z versus X right. Now, there's nothing you can do that will tell you anything about whether this was Z or X. So at best, you just guess. So you have probably a half of guessing correctly. But if you do guess correctly, so if you guess this was Z, then you do a Z measurement, and whatever outcome you got here is precisely the outcome that occurred earlier. So if you've guessed right, then you have probability one of getting green versus red right. So your overall probability of guessing which of the four preparations it was is a half. Never one. So that's the content. It's never probability one, it's only probability half. And the slogan for this is that there's no perfect information gain. You can't find out which of these four preparations it was. Okay. Now a refinement. Suppose that this, again, we have this wall and the world outside, things going on behind the wall. A system's passed out, and then it's going to be passed back behind the wall and subjected to a test. Okay, so suppose, for example, that it's prepared in the Z box, and it's going to be tested along Z, and suppose that it happened to be red, then what happens out here? If you do a Z box measurement, you get red, and then you're going to get the red outcome repeating. And so from the perspective of the person behind the wall, they get the same sorts of things as if nothing had happened outside, because if the system had just been passed out and passed back in, you would also get the red outcome. So from the perspective of somebody behind the wall, they can't tell if somebody on the outside has done a Z measurement or not. It looks just the same to them as if that hadn't happened. But what if the person on the other side of the wall does an X measurement? What happens here? It's random, exactly, because this is just a Z, X, Z configuration. And we know that an intervening X measurement between Zs randomizes the outcome. So if the guy on the outside measures with the Xbox, then the outcome here becomes random, and half the time it's red, and when it is red, then the guy behind the wall can't tell that any measurement has been done, because it's just as if the system had been passed out and passed back in. But half the time it's green, and then the guy behind the wall knows that something's happened. You know, somebody out there has gotten his grubby hands on my system and measured it in a non-Z basis. So that's the second effect we need. And I'm just going to, again, need to calculate the probability of passing this test behind the wall. So here the probability is just the probability of getting Z versus X right. So this is either going to be a Z preparation and test, or it's going to be an X preparation and test. So it's the probability of getting that right times the probability of passing the test, given that you got it right, plus the probability of getting it wrong and then passing the test, given that you got it wrong. Again, you know nothing about whether this was Z or X, so that probability of getting it right is a half. But if you happen to guess correctly, then you measure along the same basis, and the guy behind the wall can't tell. You always pass the test. So if you guess Z in this case, then you always will pass this test and get the red outcome. So that's probability one here. But note that even if you guessed wrong, right? So suppose you put an Xbox here. Well, half the time, you still get the red outcome. And so that is passing the test. You only fail the test when the guy behind the wall gets a different outcome. So even though half the time you guess wrong, you still have a probability of half of passing the test, getting lucky and not being detected. So the total probability is just 3/4. Okay? So if you are insistent upon doing a measurement and you just guess whether you should do Z or X, then overall your probability of passing this test is 3/4. Okay. The slogan is that if you try to gain information, so you don't let the system be, you subject it to a measurement, then you necessarily cause a disturbance. And by this I mean you run a risk of having that intervention detected by the person behind the wall. Okay, so you can never get away with zero probability of being detected. There's always some probability of being detected, in this case, 1/4. All right, and that's all I want to tell you about the basic phenomena. And it's going to be enough now to introduce some interesting applications of quantum mechanics. So this is quantum information theory. So the next bit of the talk is all about quantum information theory. So the first application I'm going to tell you about is quantum counterfeit proof money. So here's the idea. You take a $20 bill and you embed in it a little storage chamber, actually many storage chambers, for these systems. So previously I was talking about cases where these were the spins of silver atoms, but there's lots of different systems that could be put into these boxes that would have the same sorts of effects. So you can explore lots of different ways of doing this, but let's say they're atoms and it's their spin degree of freedom that's being prepared. So the bank basically chooses Z's and X at random, okay, and measures them, and they get green and red outcomes at random. So they have this random string of preparations. Each preparation is one of those four possibilities. And they write down in a logbook, you know, the first atom was Z green, the second atom was Z red, and they put them into these storage chambers. And in the logbook, they mark down the serial number of this bill, wherever it is. Actually, I don't think it has one because it's a specimen. Anyways, so they have a logbook, and they've got the serial number of the money, and they have the list of exactly how those atoms were prepared. And then they pass it out into the world. And I should say this isn't a viable technology today, because we currently don't have good ways of storing quantum systems such that they're isolated from their environment and can persist in their quantum state unchanged for long periods of time. So that's the technological challenge here, is to build such storage devices, which are called quantum memory. And we can't store these quantum systems for very long currently, so this sort of application is ruled out. But maybe someday in the future, you will have those things. So this is the scheme. They've prepared it at the bank. They pass it out into the world. And then this money can change hands. But ultimately, if somebody wants to test whether this is a counterfeit or a genuine piece of money, they just bring it back to the bank. And there's clever ways they can bring it back to the bank without having to go there themselves. I won't go into that. But suppose they just bring it back to the bank. And the bank then looks at the serial number and takes each of those atoms and tests it along the correct basis. So they know to test the first atom along the Z basis, the second along the Z, the third along the X. And so they do all these tests in the right bases. And they see if they get the same outcomes as are registered in the logbook. And of course, if you're a counterfeiter, then what you want to figure out is which of the four preparations was done for each atom, and then make a whole bunch of copies of this money with each atom prepared in the right way. Right? So if you could make 100 copies, all of which would get back to the bank and pass this test, well, you can make a lot of money. You just counterfeited 100 bills. But the only way you're going to find out which of these four preparations was done is if you can get a bit of information about them. You're going to have to do some measurements. Because the information about which it was is sealed away in the bank, and I'm assuming you don't have access to that. So the only access you have to which of the four preparations was done is the actual state of that system. So you'd better go and do some measurements on it if you want to find some information. But now you have a problem. You don't know whether to measure Z or X. So you have to just guess. So this guy here, he's guessed X, 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 Z, X. And he got some of them right, like the third one he guessed right. But the others he guessed wrong. And so what's going to happen, what happens is that, say, the first atom, for example, gets passed through this X measurement. What's the probability it passes the test here?
Yeah, at the mid.
So, okay, first of all, what's the probability here of getting X green, for example? So it's come out of this device. So you get 50-50. And now let's say it gets fed back in and passed through this device. You still get 50-50 because this is just Z, X, Z, and we know that an intervening X measurement randomizes a Z outcome. So if the counterfeiter gets lucky, then at the bank they get the Z green outcome and they say, yeah, first atom's okay. As far as we can tell, nobody's tampered with it. But now if I look at the second measurement, again, it's Z, X, Z, 50-50 probability for getting red. So again, the counterfeiter just has to get lucky. And if you have enough atoms in here, then you'll have lots of cases where the counterfeiter has guessed wrong, and eventually he gets unlucky, and the opposite outcome occurs from how it was prepared, and the people at the mint know that somebody's tampered with this money. Is that clear? No? So what's the probability? Suppose I have eight, in my example here, I have eight things embedded in there. What's the probability that you could... what is the probability that you could guess correctly? I think probably, yeah, well, if you guess every one of those Z's and X's correctly, then you can measure, find out whether each is red or green, and make as many copies as you want, all of which will then pass the test at the bank. So that's the worst possible outcome for the mint, that you can make an arbitrary number of copies and pass the test with certainty. But the probability for that is, for a single atom, it's just a half that you guessed Z versus X right. And if there's eight of those systems embedded, then it's a half to the power 8. So that's very low. So you have a very small probability that you could just guess correctly how this thing was prepared and able to make a large number of copies. And if the mint's not comfortable with that probability, they just need to increase the number of systems. Yes? Are you saying he's trying to counterfeit many different bills?
Yeah,
he's
counterfeiting bills, and he gets lucky in one. He didn't guess it correctly.
Right.
I mean, the next bill can also pass the
bills. So I'm not exactly sure. Let's consider two situations. That the different bills that are in circulation all have different serial numbers, and they've all been prepared differently. So maybe I wasn't clear about that. That's really key. Because if a whole bunch of different bills were all prepared Z green, X red, Z red, you know, in the same sequence, then all the guy would have to do is get a collection that have all been prepared the same way, and start doing statistics. And like I said before in answer to one of the questions, if you have a large number of systems that have all been prepared the same way, then you can figure out how they're prepared. So it's really important that every single bill is prepared differently. Yes?
There's like we're only treating like the two states here, right?
Yep.
How many states are there actually?
Actually, there's a continuum of possibilities. But the scheme remains the same, that this scheme works where the mint just chooses one of two possible bases, each of which has one of two possible outcomes. So the mint can use these four states. What you have to do in a more sophisticated analysis is just prove that no matter what measurement out of the continuum of possibilities the counterfeiter does, he still can't estimate which of those four states was prepared. That's right, yeah. But the idea here is that theoretically, if we could build these quantum storage devices, then we'd have a way of building money that could only be counterfeit with very low probability. And what's nice about that is that this is a cryptographic scheme. So it's a bizarre kind of cryptography, but counterfeit protection is a kind of cryptography where you're trying to hide things from an adversary. And typically, you do these sorts of things with other approaches, like, you know, maybe you do watermarking or so on. I don't know exactly what all the sophisticated counterfeiting schemes are. But all those things just rely on your adversary having technology that's maybe not as good as yours, or, you know, not enough technology to make an exact duplicate. It doesn't rely on the laws of physics. There's nothing that prevents me from the laws of physics of duplicating a $20 bill. I could do a very sophisticated analysis of it and reproduce it. Whereas here, the laws of physics protect me against the possibility of duplicating. And so it's a much safer position to be in.
Probability, but I mean, if you take this sort of probability and you've got a million different bills, even if
yep.
they're prepared differently, your probability still go up if you do it a million times.
Good, good. Right. So if you're a counterfeiter who can get his hands on enough bills such that his overall probability of getting one of them right becomes high, then you're in luck. So when the mint's designing this scheme, they have to make sure that the number of systems they use is large enough such that the probability of being able to make an exact duplicate is still much smaller than 1 over the number of copies that are in circulation. As long as they do that, then they're safe. Yeah, that's very good. It's a subtle point, but you're absolutely right. Other questions? Okay, so the next question is the following. Suppose you tried to do a counterfeiting job, and then instead of trying to take your counterfeit copies and bring them to the bank, you just try to take that original back to the bank, the one that you tampered with, the one you did some measurements on. What's your probability of passing the test then? Well, remember, every time you try to gain some information, your probability of passing the test at the bank, I showed this a few slides back, was 3/4. Because half the time you guess right and your probability is of passing the test is 1. Half the time you've guessed Z versus X wrong, but you still have a probability a half of getting lucky and getting the right outcome and so evading detection. So your overall probability is 3/4. And if you measure each one of those systems, then the total probability that your original passes the test is 3/4 to the power 8, which is also a small probability. So not only does this scheme make it so that you can't reliably generate a large number of copies that pass the test at the bank, any attempt at counterfeiting actually compromises the original. You can't even take the original back to the bank and have it pass a test. Yes?
Actual application, because to make this useful to prevent counterfeiting bills, you have to pass this information around to the stores and stuff that are going to be using it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, well, like the banks would still be fine, but the counterfeiters could still buy products and make profit off of it and get real bills back.
Okay, so you could imagine that. I see it's a practical difficulty, right? You know, you don't want the store owner to say, hang on, I'm going to take this bill over to the mint down the street and check it and then come back. Because you're right, I mean, if every store owner had the information that the MIT has, it would be very low security. So you want to keep the serial numbers and the lists of preparations in the MIT. But there's a clever scheme called quantum teleportation, which means that actually the store owner can transfer the quantum states of his systems into the MIT as long as he shares something called an entangled state with the MIT and has a classical communication channel. So in practice, what you could have is that all store keepers have this resource of entanglement with the MIT. And anytime they want to check a bill, they just have to classically communicate with the MIT. They basically teleport the state over there. The MIT checks it. And the MIT says, yeah, that was OK. And they can teleport it back. And they have the money. So there are ways around these practical difficulties. But you know, even if there weren't, I think it's still interesting that you know this sort of thing is possible, even if perhaps it isn't a good practical solution to the problem of counterfeiting. Other questions about that? OK, so the moral of the story here is that in the future, when we have quantum money, because any attempt at counterfeiting means that the original won't pass the test, whatever you do with your quantum money, don't try to measure it, because it won't be any good. Right, so that's it for the quantum money. I'm going to move on to the second application, which is the detection of eavesdroppers. Okay, so the idea in cryptography is to have a private channel. So this is one of the key cryptographic applications. Alice and Bob want to communicate in private, but if they use a standard scheme, such as the telephone, then an eavesdropper, who we always call Eve, can put a wiretap on the channel and hear everything they're saying. And so they have no security in this sort of scheme. But there are ways around this. So here's an attempt at having better security. It's called the Caesar cipher. Suppose the message that Alice wants to send to Bob is the following text, meet me at the river. OK, then they could agree ahead of time, and maybe you've played this game when you were young, to shift each letter in the message by some fixed amount. So they agree ahead of time that their key is going to be 2. They're going to shift every letter in the alphabet by 2. That's going to be their code. And you know, with circular boundary conditions, Z gets shifted to B, and so on. And so they shift every letter, and so Alice sends this message instead of the original. And then Bob gets it. He takes every letter, shifts it back by 2, and recovers the appropriate message. Now, do you see any problems with this scheme? What could a clever eavesdropper do? Maybe right back there. Yeah.
Well, all he has to do is like go through like 1 to 26 and like move each letter up 1, then try it again 2, and see if he can just make a sentence out of it.
Exactly. In this case, it's very easy for him. He only has to do these 26 possibilities, and he can find out which of the 26 they used. There's another problem with it, that even if they use a slightly more sophisticated scheme, there are good attacks.
It's open to frequency analysis because, like for example, E occurs much more frequently than, which is the most occurring letter in English, than say Q, which is the least one. So, you could just, if it's a long enough message, the eavesdropper could just measure how many times each letter occurs, and then start matching them up with.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's even if they use a slightly more sophisticated scheme. If they have enough text, then it turns out that the frequency with which different letters occur in the English language is very precise. And so they can start making guesses. You know, they pick the most frequent letter, and they say, well, let's assume that's an E. And then, they start, and maybe they do that with a few more letters. And then all of a sudden, they start seeing patterns, and they can start figuring out what other letters are. They can see, oh, maybe that didn't make sense as an E. Let's try something else. And eventually, they can decrypt what every letter is supposed to be using that sort of scheme. So fortunately, there's a cryptographic cipher that's immune to those sorts of attacks. It's called the Vernon cipher. It's very simple. The idea is that for each letter in the message, you have a different key. Right? So each letter is going to be shifted by some number between 0 and 26. And there's Alice and Bob are originally going to share a key for every letter in the message. So their key will say that the first letter should be shifted by 7, the second by 20, the first by 4. Alice encodes Bob gets it, he looks at his long key, he takes every one of them, shifts it back by the right amount, and recovers. And the reason this is secure is that every possible key, right, so there's 26 to the power n different possible keys that could be used. And the assumption is that AltiBob chooses at random. From among all 26 to the n possible keys, they choose one at random. And now, if the eavesdropper wants to do an exhaustive search, right, she could decipher this message according to all 26 to the n possible keys. And at the end of the day, she says, right, each of these decryptions is equally likely to have been what Alice and Bob wanted to send to one another. And so in the end, she knows just as much as if she just guessed what Alice, you know, what the first letter that Alice sent was and what the second letter that Alice sent was. She learns just no more than if she were just to guess. Because in the end, if Alice and Bob are just sending each letter between 0 and 26 with equal probability, then every message has probability 1 over 26 to the n. And that's exactly Alice's, the eavesdropper's probability of getting the right message out. So that's called information theoretic security. The eavesdropper learns nothing more than she could have just by guessing. And so this is fine. Can you see any problems? I'm not problems with the scheme. Let me just say that the trouble here is just that Alice and Bob require this really big key. The more messages they want to transmit to one another, the more key they need. And so, for example, if they spent a long time communicating, you know, Bob is an agent in the field, Alice is the spy back at headquarters, they spent a long time communicating, eventually, say, Bob runs out of key. So now Alice has to maybe send an agent with a briefcase handcuffed to them out to Bob to replenish the key. So the problem really becomes one of key distribution. How do you get fresh key out into the field? Because you can't use the old key over again. If you start using the same key many times, then the eavesdropper has attacks available to them. They can start getting information about what you're transmitting. So this is where quantum mechanics comes in. Quantum mechanics gives you a way of establishing this key distribution where your security relies only on the laws of physics. Okay, so if you want to do private communication, you just use the Vernon cipher, but you've set up your key using a quantum scheme. So essentially, you replace the communication line with something like fiber optic cables where you can send quantum systems, and you go through a protocol that allows you to set up common key. And then you just use your classical communication line with the Vernon cipher encoding using that key. Yes? Yes, you can. So you can send any quantum state of a photon you like can be sent down a fiber optic, including states that are entangled with things that are left behind. Because of interactions with the environment, typically it's difficult to send quantum states over long distances, just like it's difficult to store them in length space for a long period of time. So that's another technological difficulty. But here we're doing a bit better even today. So we have things like quantum repeaters that allow you to get around those sorts of problems. So in the future, it's likely that we'll have very long distance quantum communication channels. Good? All right, let's see how it works. So this should be sort of obvious by now. So here's the scheme they use. Alice is going to prepare a whole bunch of systems at random, whether she prepares them with a set or X is chosen at random, and the outcome is random. But each one of them is prepared in one of these four possible ways. She sends them down the channel. Bob receives them, and he measures each one of them along either Z or X, just chosen at random. Okay, so he chooses Z or X at random because he doesn't know how Alice has prepared them. So he chooses them at random. And then they communicate. After all the systems have arrived in Bob's lab, they announce what they've measured, right? So Alice says, on the first one I measured Z, Bob says, on the first one I measured Z. They keep that one because their measurements were the same, and they discard the ones where their measurements were different. Okay, so they discard the second one because their measurements were different, and the fifth one. And they just get rid of those systems, and they're not going to be used in the rest of the protocol. So now they're just left with systems where Bob's measurement was exactly the same as Alice's preparation. And let's say they have a whole lot of these. Then what they do is they just choose some subset of them at random. So a small subset of this large collection system is chosen at random, and these ones are going to be used to test for an eavesdropper. And if they find an eavesdropper, then they know they can't use the rest of them. But if they find no eavesdropper, no evidence of an eavesdropper on this random subset, then they'll be confident that the rest of the systems, there was also no eavesdropper, and they can be used as a key. That's the idea. So what are the tests they do? Well, on that small subset, they just announce what outcomes they got. So Alice says, well, I got green for the Z measurement on the first one. And Bob says, I got green as well. OK, good. That's consistent with there having been no eavesdropper. Take this one here. Alice announces that she got green for her X measurement on the fourth. Bob says, oh, I got red for my X measurement. And so it's clear that it couldn't have been that the system just passed through undisturbed, because had nothing happened to it, Bob would have gotten the green outcome. Because it always has to repeat. If I have an X measurement, then an X measurement, the outcome should repeat. So here they know, uh-oh, something's happened. Probably it's possible that there's an eavesdropper who did a measurement and found out some information about our system. So in fact, if there was an eavesdropper, then of course she doesn't know what Alice prepared. So she also has to guess at random whether it was Z or X. And some of the time, she might guess correctly. So here she guessed Z correctly, and she evaded detection. Some of the time, she might guess incorrectly, but still get lucky. So here she guessed X, she was wrong, but it just so happened that Bob's Z measurement got the red outcome. And that happens with probability half. So she got lucky, wasn't detected. But here, she got unlucky, and she was eventually detected. And if you do this on enough systems, then you can make the probability of detecting an eavesdropper very high. And so you can know if somebody has tampered with these systems. And if you find an eavesdropper, then you just don't try. Don't use that key for future Vernim ciphers. So it's just a way of detecting eavesdroppers, not evading them. There are more sophisticated schemes called privacy amplification, which allows you to take something which an eavesdropper might have found out a bit of information about and hash it in certain ways to get something about which the eavesdropper has no information. But this scheme is really just about knowing whether there was an eavesdropper there or not. So, questions about that? Yes?
So let's say we have some people who don't really want to know what you're talking about, but he or she just like, I want to stop you two from communicating. So I can, what I do, I act as if I'm an eavesdropper,
yep.
I do that and I stop you two from communication then.
Yes.
So, but that would be like very difficult for some military use, and they have to communicate in a sense. But if there is somebody who can like stop the communication so easily, then that would not work.
It's true that this doesn't give you protection against somebody trying to jam your channel. Like, for example, you know, they could just cut your channel, and then, you know, the atoms sent from Alice to Bob don't get through, and maybe they could even jam your classical signals. But in a sense, that's not as bad as a situation wherein we think we have privacy, but we don't. And that's the thing you really, in cryptography, you want to avoid, where we think we're communicating in private, but in fact, somebody knows everything that we're saying to one another. So this is really a protection against a deceptive attack. You know, so the enemy really wants you to think that you're safe when you're not. And so here we can know that we're safe, or know that we shouldn't communicate because somebody's been eavesdropping on the channel. In the back.
Yes. So we'd have to run through the entire key, right? Checking all of them to know which ones to accept, right?
That's right, yep. Where you just announce what was measured, X or Z, you don't announce what outcome, green or red.
Oh, and it's the outcome that gives you the information?
And it's the, yeah, I should have said that, I'm sorry. What you get at the end is a bunch of, you know, greens and reds. So you have this long list of, you know, green for this guy, red for that guy, so on. And then you turn those into zeros and ones. And then you have a long sequence of zeros and ones that are in common between Alice and Bob. And you can turn those, you know, using an ASCII code into, you know, letters if you want, and use that Vernim cipher I talked about. That's right.
Cool.
Okay, well, I'm going to move on from cryptography, so if there's no more questions about this, let's move on. So this next part of the talk is about what it all means. So no more about how to use quantum mechanics. Hopefully I've convinced you that there's some interesting stuff you can do. Now the question is, well, how do we make sense of all this phenomenology I've told you about? So there's an idea in the interpretations of quantum mechanics called the hidden variable model, which I think is a very beautiful idea, and I want to give you a flavor for how it works. So to do that, I think that the best way is to talk about Plato's allegory of the cave. So we have to go all the way back to ancient Greece, Plato in the Republic described this interesting situation. He said, imagine you have some prisoners that for their entire lives have lived in a cave, and they've been shackled there and forced to look forward for their entire lives at this wall. And on the wall is projected shadows of images that pass behind them. And there's a light behind those images, those objects, and they cast shadows on the wall. And Plato's argument, so this is a dialogue between Socrates and a guy called Glaucon, and Socrates basically says, look, do you really think that these guys won't these guys expect these shadows to be the reality? They'll interpret the shadows as reality. So he's basically saying that we're like the people in the cave. We see things around us, we interpret them as real, but really they're just aspects of the reality. Much like the shadows here can be various different aspects of a single three-dimensional object. I can show you lots of two-dimensional shadows, but you can never see the full three-dimensional object at once if you're one of the prisoners. So Plato says we're like that. The point of this analogy is that a hidden variable model is a bit like this as well. Rather than saying the quantum state is the entire reality, you could say, well, all we ever see are aspects of a reality. So we can see one shadow or another shadow, so I can, you know, project it one way or project another way, see lots of different two-dimensional slices of this object, but never the full object. Similarly, maybe I can never see all the properties of a system at once. I can only see one of its properties at a time. So let me be specific with a particular kind of theory that is meant to explain the kind of phenomena I told you about early on in the talk. So this is actually a toy theory because it doesn't reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics exactly, but it will reproduce everything I've told you about so far. And it's a toy theory that involves a restriction on how much people know. So the idea is this. You remember our X and Z boxes. Suppose that actually what happens with systems is that they have values, that they have internal degrees of freedom. And one internal degree of freedom is basically an X degree of freedom. It has a value, which you could think of as whether it's going to give the green or the red outcome. But you could just say it's, you know, X is just a variable that takes values 0 or 1, corresponding to green and red. And similarly, it has a property associated with Z. So it has a property that determines whether it will give the green or the red outcome in a Z-box measurement. So that's the second property here, and I'll just say Z is 0 or 1. And so its state space is just this two-dimensional space that has just two possibilities for each, and it has, therefore, four states. So Z and X can both be green, or one can be green and the other can be red, and so on. So you can imagine that these systems are really prepared to answer any question you pose of them, but we, as observers, can only have limited information about that physical state. So we can never know precisely what the value of X and the value of Z is at the same time. We can only know one of them at a time. So for example, we could know that X is has value 0, or would yield green in an X measurement, or that X has value 1. Or we might know the value of Z. These diagrams are meant to represent uniform probability distributions. So I assign probability 0 to X equal to 1 here, and probability a half to each of these guys. So I know with probability 1 in total that X was 0, but all I can say about Z was that it was equally likely to be 0 or 1. So all these guys are uniform distributions. So this is a bit like the situation with position and momentum and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So if you've heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it's often stated as you can't know simultaneously the position and the momentum. You can choose to know one, or you can choose to know the other, but you can't know them simultaneously. So here the X and the Z are like discrete degrees of freedom that are like position and momentum. And in fact, mathematically, they have you can formulate this in such a way that they have symplectic symmetry. So that's the symmetry that's important for position and momentum. In any case, you can know these sorts of things, and one small detail is that you could also know x plus z mod 2. So you can know that their sum is 0 or their sum is 1 mod 2. And that's just like how in quantum mechanics, you can also know the value of x plus p. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm not going to really need that for our purposes. It will be useful, though, to know that you could also know nothing. You can know neither of these variables, in which case you just have a uniform distribution over all four of these possible states. So that's the idea of the model. It's like the shadows in the cave. You can only have partial information about the underlying states. So how does it recover what we saw earlier? Well, here are the only measurements that are allowed, consistent with that constraint that you can never come to know too much. You could just measure x or measure z or measure their sum. So here I just distinguish by different colors the different possible outcomes you would get. And now you could ask, well, what would happen if I start with something, a system about which I know nothing, and pass it through one of these z-boxes? Well, the z-box just asks, is it one of these two states or one of those two states? And because these all get same probability, the answer is, you know, with probability half, you'll get green. With probability half, you'll get red. You're just asking what property the system originally had. So you can reproduce that prediction. Same with an x measurement. You're just asking, you know, what the x value was ahead of time. Are equally likely. And then you can ask, well, what happens to the system after the measurement is complete? What you want is for a subsequent x measurement to give you exactly the same outcome, right? That's what we always find in these experiments, that a subsequent x measurement would also give me the green outcome. So what are the valid probability distributions that will get me the green outcome here? Well, it could be that the system state was here or it was here. But all I can know about it is that it's equally likely to be here or here, because I can't know anything more. I can't know that it's definitely here. That would be knowing too much. So the only distributions that would give me the green outcome in this subsequent measurement would be this one. So it must be that after this measurement's complete, this is what I'm left knowing about the system. And that actually makes sense, because if you think about it, you know, you do this measurement, which is just asking which of the four boxes it's in, and you find it's not in one of the red boxes. So you assign probability 0 to those. And what's left over, you just have equal probability for those two guys. So it's consistent with just updating your information. And similarly, for a Z measurement, the only thing that'll reproduce the outcomes is if you have a distribution that's uniform over Z red, for example. One other thing you can ask is, can we reproduce the randomness we get in this measurement when it follows a Z measurement? So let's say we get green. We collapse. This is the hidden variable explanation of collapse. It's just an updating of your probability distribution, an updating of your knowledge. So if you get the green outcome here, well, you know that the state was in one of those two boxes. So you have a uniform distribution over them. And now you do a measurement of x. But it's equally likely to be found in one of these guys or one of those guys, because it has equal probability of being up or down. So you get 50-50 statistics, as we found early on. So you're explaining all this stuff. The final question would be, well, what happens with things like x, z, x? And so I need to know, well, what's going to be the final distribution if I first measure z and then I measure x? And again, if I want to reproduce the outcome, so if I did another x measurement here, I would always get red. The only distribution that does that is the one that's uniform over this x red region. So I know that I have to get this distribution at the end. And the question is, how does that happen? How does the hidden variable theory guarantee that I get that sort of distribution? Because the more natural thing would be to get the following distribution. If initially I know that z is green, and then I measure that x is red, that's like saying, well, you knew it was on this half, and then you find out it's in the upper half. So if you were just updating your knowledge, you would say, well, it's definitely here, because it was on the left, and I just found it on the top, so it's in the left top. So this is exactly what you would get if there was no physical disturbance to the system when you did that measurement. But that would violate the assumption of this hidden variable model, that you can never come to know everything about the state. So we know that this is impossible. There can't be consistently no physical disturbance. It would violate the postulate. So what we do is we imagine that actually, some of the time, if you get the red outcome, you disturb the z value. So you actually flip the value of z. There's some physical disturbance to the system. So if you assume that those two things occur with equal probability, that either it stays put in the top or it moves over, then you do get the right final distribution. So you can reproduce all this phenomenology as long as you assume that measurements not only can't discover everything, but when they try to measure x, they disturb the value of z. And that's like in position and momentum. If I measure position, I disturb momentum. If I measure momentum, I disturb position. So the idea is that a measurement of x changes the value of z with probability a half. And therefore, if I did a subsequent z measurement here, I would get a random outcome, because half the time it would still be green, but half the time it would have switched to red. So anyways, that was a long-winded set of stuff just to show you that this idea that there's properties there that we're finding things about and sometimes disturbing can actually explain everything that I've used so far in this talk. So although you may have heard that there's problems with hidden variable models, they're really quite good at explaining a lot of quantum mechanics. Everything I've said so far, no problem for a hidden variable model. But there are problems nonetheless. And Bell's theorem is the best example of what problems there are with hidden variable models. So I'm going to tell you, this is the final thing I'm going to talk about, why any realistic account of quantum mechanics, including hidden variable models, has to be non-local. So I need to introduce a little bit of some new devices. We need to be able to generate entangled states. One way to do it is to pass photons through something called a nonlinear crystal, which makes them split into a pair of photons of lower frequency. And they come out in these funny cone-shaped structures. And some of the time, the two photons happen to come out on the intersections, these intersection points of the two cones. And in those cases, these two photons are in an entangled state. I won't tell you about the mathematics about those. I'll just tell you what happens if I feed one of these photons out one port, feed the other out another port, and start doing measurements on them. So we're just going to talk about the phenomena we get. And we'll just put this whole thing in a box with two ports with an E on it, as I've indicated here. So the experiment that's going to be important here is one where one of the photons is sent off over here to Alice, and the other is sent off to Bob. And they're going to do measurements. So I'm going to call one of their measurements S. So it's like an X measurement, but it's possibly different from an X measurement. And then there's also going to be another measurement called T. So maybe Alice does S, Bob does T. Or maybe Alice does T and Bob does S. Or maybe they both do T. Or maybe they both do S. Those are the only four possible measurements they're going to do. OK, and now for the next bit to explain how this is going to work, I need two volunteers from the audience. Back, and you're here. OK. Just come up to the front. And the tradition here is to have cash prizes for volunteers if they satisfy the challenge. So does anyone have a hat that we could store the cash prize in? OK, hat man. You can hang up that. It's a $2 Canadian cash prize. So maybe you want to just stand somewhere where you can see the overhead. And you can move off to either side. That's good. OK, so here's the situation. You're going to be simulating the photons. Okay, so you're going to be faced with measurements. And just like the photon, you're going to have to decide how to respond to those measurements. Okay, and so here's the setup. There's going to be two possible measurements that you each can get, S or T. Okay, and ultimately what's going to happen is I'm going to give you an envelope with a piece of paper that has S or T written on it. And so that's going to tell you which of your measurements you had. And you're going to have to generate an outcome, which is green or red. So you're just going to write that on the piece of paper. And I've chosen these things at random. Okay, so whether you each get S or T is 50-50 probability. So you're equally likely to get the four possibilities. And then you have to make sure that your answers follow the following rules. If it happens that you both have been asked the same question, so you both got S or you both got T, then you have to give answers that agree. So either both green or both red. But if your questions were different, then your answers had better disagree. Okay. Now the trick is that you're not allowed to open your envelope, find out your letter, and tell your partner what letter you got. Ahead of time, you get to collaborate and make a plan. So your plan could be, if we both, you know, if you get S, do this. If I get S, I'll do this, and so forth. Okay? So I give you a moment to collaborate, and the rest of you should be thinking about what kind of scheme you could use to win the game with high likelihood. So you can discuss amongst yourselves what you think a good strategy would be. The piece of paper has a letter written on it. You're each going to get S or T. You're going to be up on opposite sides of the rooms, and we're going to be watching you to make sure you don't. Red or green? Yeah. That's right.
Figure out a way to get all these two have to be sent by
them. You have to satisfy these two rules. Okay, so you have a plan. Okay. Why don't you go over to that side? Okay. So the contestants have a plan. All right, so here we go. Hang on. Don't open it quite yet. Here you go. All right, now you can open them, and we're watching you to make sure you don't communicate to one another. No, no telepathy allowed. Oh, thanks. Okay, all right, getting back to me. Now the moment of truth. Who's got the money? All right, so on the left, the question was S, and the answer was red. Barely legible. And on the other side was also S, and the answer was red.
Where's it?
And so you win, because if the questions were the same, the outcomes were supposed to agree, your outcomes agree, so we have the award ceremony now. good. So let me ask, what was the scheme you used? Did you have a scheme?
Yeah, we just said that if we, like, no matter what it comes out to be, we have, like, a set result. So, like, if he gets, like, S, we just said if we both get S, we'll say red. If we both say, if we both get T, we'll say green. And if we get different, then we're different. Great. We satisfy rule number two.
Good, good. Exactly. Okay, so let me draw your scheme like this. So you basically said if I get S, I'm going to report green. You said the same. If I get S, I'm going to report green. And you said if you get T, you're going to get red, similarly over here. And so now if you're if you both get the same, then it's green, green. If you get T and T, it's red, red. But if it's any of S and T, then your colors disagree, similarly here. And that's how you did it. Well done. Okay, so now now that you know how easy it is, I need two more volunteers. And there's another two loonies to be won. So who wants to take my money? Here? Anyone else? Okay, at the back. Yeah. Good.
I win. Yeah, take my hat.
And, right, for the hat. There you go. Okay, so the rules have changed. Here's what you have to do. So can you maybe position yourself where you can see the screen? Okay, so again, each of you is going to be presented with one of two possible measurements. So you're simulating the photons. You're going to be measured along S or T. And you're each going to have to generate one of two outcomes, green or red. And the S and the T, which are the new red. Now, here, if you get the same measurement, then your outcomes should disagree. And if you get different measurements, then your outcomes should agree. So talk amongst yourselves. Let me know when you're ready. The rest of you should be coming up with schemes. Yours? Yours? Over here? Thanks a lot. It's very much trouble opening the envelope. That's right, Ben. Okay. So, on this side, we had S. The answer was red. And on the right, we had T, and the answer was red. And you win. Because if they're different, then the answer should agree. Well done. So, what was your scheme?
My scheme was that if I get S and I see red, yes. I get T, I get green. And the opposite for him.
Exactly. Right. So, it's just what I've drawn here. If you always answer opposite, then when you've got T and S or S and T, then your colors will be the same. But if you have SS or TT, your colors are different. And that's what you did. So you would have always won. So you can collect your prize. Okay. So there's two more dollars to be won. But this is going to be harder. Much harder. Okay, so now we're getting to the guts of Bell's theorem. So, thanks. We're not going to act this one out, so I'm going to ask all of you to try to think of a scheme. So, the fundamental structure is the same. Each photon is subjected to a measurement S or T, with equal probability being S or T, and has to report an outcome, green or red. But now, the rule is the following. If the measurement is T on both of the photons, then the outcomes should disagree. But if it's any of the other three possibilities, then the outcomes should agree. Okay, so if it's SS or ST or TS, the outcomes should agree. So $2 for anyone who can. Can you repeat? You mean you would like to try to solve the puzzle?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, go for it. Well, actually, no, maybe give everyone just a few minutes to think about it, but I'll take you first. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes to think about schemes you might use to win this game. You can talk amongst yourselves.
Two T's and the two different ones and two different T's.
Thank you.
All right. Well, what are you? You say you have a proposed solution. Would you like to?
I only wanted to try.
You wanted to do the thing. Oh, sorry. We're not going to act this one out. I'm just looking for somebody to give me a possible scheme. So, do you guys want more time or? Some people want more. I'll give you just a little bit more time, and then I'll go with you.
There's a question for you guys.
Yes, clarification.
Yeah. Is it always possible, in this case, is it possible to always win if you have the right system, or is it still, does it work on probability?
Well, it's up to you to figure out. Okay, well, why don't you tell me, so we have one proposal for a scheme.
What if we try the one person, like, if they get T, they'll get red.
Okay.
And then the other person two, they get T, they'll get green.
Okay.
And everything else is red, no matter what.
Everything else is red. So let me, okay, let's write this down. So you said if this person gets asked T,
yeah,
then they answer red. And if this guy gets asked T, he answers green. And I think everything else is red. So if this guy gets S, he answers red. And if this guy gets S, he answers red. And that's going to be a problem because if they both get asked S, then their answers are going to agree, but they should disagree. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's not the problem. Thank you. Yes, you're quite right. The problem, this is fine. The problem is that here, if one gets asked S and the other gets asked T, their answers disagree, but we're told that if one gets asked S and the other gets asked T, their answers should agree. Sorry, that would be the problem with that scheme. Yes?
Always, whenever you do whatever scheme you want, but then there'll be always one pair which won't work, at least one pair which won't work, so no scheme will work for this.
Good, good. That's absolutely right. So you win $2. Oh, that's just, then you're like really breaking it in. you can't win the game with certainty. And the reason is that no matter what set of answers you write down, you're always going to have one of those links that doesn't have the right correlations. So, for example, this one here, there was this link here had the wrong correlation. And if you think about it, you'll find that there's lots of different ways of coloring these, but the best you can ever do is to win 3/4 of the time. You can get 3 of those links with the right correlation. One will always have the wrong. So if you play this game, at the highest probability you have of winning is 3/4. Good. So the answer to this question is 3/4. And here I've just shown it as the case where if they answer green and green for SS, ST, and ST, then they get the wrong correlations for TT. It would have to be red to get the right correlations for TT. So you can only win the game with 75% of the time using these local strategies. But here's the amazing thing. If you use entangled quantum states and you choose the S and T measurements appropriately, it turns out the photons manage to win this game 85% of the time. And the question is, how do the photons do it? How do they win this game 85% of the time? I guess the question one could ask is, if the actual game we played here, how could you cheat and win more than 75% of the time? Talk to each other. So what would you tell each other? Right. If in the example I gave here, if the player on the left informed the player on the right whether they got S or T, then the player on the right could respond to the T question appropriately. If the player on the left got asked S, then he would know answer green. But if he got asked T, then he would know to answer red and get the correlations right all of the time. So if they could communicate to one another, they could win this game more than 75% of the time. But there's a problem with that. It has to do with relativity. Mm-hmm. Suppose you set up the game in such a way that rather than just, you know, watching the participants and making sure they don't communicate to one another, you set it up so that the photons are measured. So this is the photon that gets sent over to the left side. At a particular time, the measurement is chosen, and a short time later, that photon, that device has to register an outcome. Similarly, over here on the right. And those times are chosen such that even if the photon on the left starts sending a signal at the speed of light over to the right, informing what's on the right of what measurement was chosen, that signal doesn't get there in time before the outcome actually has to be reported. Okay, so you can always set these things up. As long as these two things are far enough apart and these times are short enough, you can always set it up so that light doesn't have time to get to the other party. And so this person can't find out whether S or T was measured over here. So even though they send the signal, it just doesn't get there in time. We could have done the experiment that way. I sent you guys off in spaceships, and I make sure that, you know, I have an agent out there on each end, and you have to give me your outcome quickly. And there's just no time for light to get there after you've opened the envelope. So you could do that. Now, what would you expect? So there's two possibilities. If we did this experiment, we could get the quantum predictions, and we could find these 85% of the time they win the game. Or we could find that at most they win 75% of the time, because it's been done in these space-like separated regions. So who thinks it's going to be the quantum predictions? And who thinks it's going to be the local predictions? Good. That's sort of an easy question. So believe it or not, I mean, there are people before this experiment was done who were sufficiently convinced of locality. Their intuitions from relativity theory were so strong that they thought conceivably there could be a violation of quantum mechanics in this case. But in fact, the experiments have been done, and it seems that the quantum predictions are the correct ones. Yes?
Enough, they get the right answer 100% of the time? Like, they have
tons of the signal? No, it's basically independent of how far apart they are. So they can always win this with at most 85%. Another interesting question is why they can't win it with higher probability. So from one perspective, the mystery is why not only 75%? But another mystery is, well, why not more? Why is it only 85%? And we don't know the answer to that either. The mysterious thing, I'm going to basically end here. The mysterious thing about Bell's theorem is that if you try to come up with a realist explanation of what's going on with these correlations, some sort of explanation in terms of causes, then you have the following tension between quantum mechanics and relativity. It's not a contradiction, but it's a tension. On the one hand, the theory of relativity tells us that there's no superluminal signaling, which means that you can't send messages faster than the speed of light. Or another way to say it is that the statistics of measurement outcomes at one wing of an experiment don't depend on the choice of measurement at the other. But on the other hand, we find that superluminal influences, superluminal causes, are necessary if we want to try to explain the correlations we see in the Bell experiment in terms of causes, that there were some local instruction set that told the measurement devices how to respond. So the mystery is that if there are these superluminal influences, these superluminal causes, why can't we use them to send messages? That's the tension. And in my opinion, nobody has come up with a good answer to this problem. My view is that it's a mystery that is ripe for solution. My sense is that it's probably teaching us that something like that there's something fundamentally wrong with the framework in which we're posing this problem, which makes this seem like a tension. And perhaps if we changed some fundamental assumptions, something about our framework, this tension would disappear. But I leave you with this open problem to think about and hopefully make progress on. And thanks for your attention.
We have maybe just a couple of minutes for questions, because our mentors are out there. So just a few questions.
Yeah.
This is kind of a random question. What's life like at Cambridge?
it's good. Yeah, it's a beautiful place. Lots of smart people there. I'm not part of a college, and so if any of you go to Cambridge someday, I would recommend getting be part of a college, because that's a large part of Cambridge life, which I missed out. But it's a really nice place, yeah.
It's all on the same line. How is it at Medial University, rather than Quebec now in
the city? So I did a physics and philosophy program, which was really good for me because the physics program there is very intensive. And I found it really nice to have some philosophy courses every term. And you know, for the philosophy courses, you're writing essays. For the physics courses, you're doing assignments. And that was a really nice mix. But yeah, the physics program is very good, very thorough. And they have a really good philosophy department. So I assume you're going there for physics. They also have a very good physics math program. So yeah, I recommend it. It's tough going, very tough going, I found. Maybe you'll find it easier than I thought. Yes?
How would you define measurement?
How would I define a measurement? Good question. So at one level, I would define it as false. At an operational level, if I'm not asking about what's going on in reality, but I just want to talk about what some theory predicts, I could say, well, a measurement device is something that I set up and that generates an outcome, so that something happens to it which depends on what happened before that. So there's a preparation device and a measurement device. As I modify the preparation, the kinds of statistics of outcomes I get on the measurement device change. So you could say it's anything that yields an outcome in that way. But if you're thinking at a hidden variable level, then it makes more sense to say a measurement is something that either allows you to estimate things about the past. So you might be able to retrodict something about which preparation procedure was done, or retrodict something about the properties of the system that was fed into it, or predict something about what's going to come in a subsequent measurement. So it's something that allows you to update your probabilities about other things that are going on. Yes?
Could we just say that a measurement is a kind of interaction? So that we just not only say that we have to gain information from it, but to determine which passes for other things. But that it's kind of interaction, and therefore it can't, this is the colorful wave function of the particle, that there are some kind of interaction. So you don't have to gain information.
So I think
it's just a special way of interacting.
It's conceivable you could get away with that sort of definition. I'm a bit concerned because, for example, if I have a system that interacts with some environment, some degrees of freedom that, say, eventually fly off and I can never get to them, okay, so in my sort of language, the information that they carry about the system is not available to me, then personally, I don't think that, maybe there's a sense in which you could say that's a measurement because, in principle, you could get that information out. But I would prefer to call that something like noise because it's, there's a distinction between those things which you have access to and those things which you don't. And any interaction causes this system to have information about that system. That's, I think, the defining property of interactions. And whether it's a measurement or not depends on whether I actually can have access to the system. But in the end, it's just a word, so. I don't think we need to fight about how we should use it.
So is it correct to say that the measurement is a special way of an interaction?
Yes. I think that's a better definition. Yeah.
Stay on the point of measurement here. Do you think there's a relationship between measurement, observation, and consciousness?
Personally, so first let me say there are people who have proposed this in the context of interpretations of quantum mechanics and have said that what distinguishes interactions among, say, microscopic systems and interactions with a measurement device is that ultimately the measurement device gets read by some conscious observer. And the reason they introduced this distinction is because in quantum mechanics, there's two kinds of evolution. One is unitary evolution, which we apply to systems that are just evolving, isolated systems. And the other is the collapse evolution, which is the prescription for how to update the quantum state if you've done a measurement on the system. And people look for reasons why there should be these two kinds of evolutions, you know, criteria for when should you apply one evolution as opposed to another. So one of the criteria that's been proposed is that when consciousness is involved, you get the collapse type evolution as opposed to just the unitary evolution. So those are known as collapse theories, and consciousness is one example of something that could induce collapse. Personally, I don't think we have particularly good reasons for assuming that consciousness is what causes the collapse. There are more reasonable collapse models that talk about perhaps the complexity of the system inducing the collapse, or the size of the system is what determines whether it's collapsed or not. Or there are even proposals about gravity having something to do with it. Those seem to me to be more reasonable. But also, I'm more in favor of a hidden variable type approach than I am of a collapse theory approach, because my sense is that collapse should not be thought of as a physical process, something that happens to a physical state, which is how it's thought of in collapse theories, but rather a mental process. It's how you update your information about something. And I don't see any reason to posit a special role for consciousness if collapse is of that sort.
Okay, so my guess is that we can keep Rob here all the morning, the rest of the morning, asking questions. And it's wonderful, but we do have our inventors up there that are waiting. So let's thank Rob again.